Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Living and Thriving with Rusty.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon to all my blessed beloveds out there in Radio Land, Virtual Land. It is Humpity Hump Day. Very exciting. Today is sunny, and I would say probably maybe pushing 40 degrees here, maybe 45. but the sun is up, and it's just beautiful out. Amy will not be joining us today. She had a death in the family, so she is taking care of family needs. If she's out there listening, you know, prayers to you and your family. Many hugs from your friends. And I am very excited to have Jeff Evans from Mountain Vision pop on. He should be calling in shortly. He is a motivational speaker and inspiration and a crazy wild man who does major adventures all over the world. And so I'm really looking forward to learning more about what he does and why he does it and how much fun it must be just to live that kind of lifestyle. Otherwise, if you have any questions, you want to call in the number here, 347-205-9443. And you're listening to Living and Thriving with Rusty, and I'm Rusty. Not much to talk about, just waiting for Jeff to call in. That's about it. While we wait, maybe we'll play a song. We'll play Joseph Kerrigan's song, his didgeridoo, one of his wild expeditions from a long time ago. I think that would be very fitting. Joseph Kerrigan's adventure in South America, which I thought was a little appropriate because Jeff is an adventurer, crazy wild man, and he's dialed in, and he's going to tell us about who he is and what he does and why he does it. Some of those pictures on your website, Jeff, make me cold, and I'm not a cold lady.
I feel like I've, for some strange reason, I'm paying penance for my sins in my previous life, and I have to go freeze my rear off in crazy places. But I've somehow found my path going from growing up in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia and North Carolina to seeking out fun objectives around the world, and it just so happens that most of the places that I enjoy going and have really had life-changing adventures have been in the biggest mountains in the world. And I've been fortunate and blessed enough to have surrounded myself with really amazing people, individuals, and teams that have enhanced those experiences where I could have never experienced them on my own to the degree that I have with these wonderful people around me over the years.
So you founded Mountain Visions Adventure and Treks, and you are a public speaker, motivational speaker. When did you just wake up and say, hey, I want to climb the Himalayan mountains and speak to big corporations? Or what was the motivating factor?
No, you know, if someone wakes up and says they want to go do that, they need to go sit on a couch somewhere and talk to a therapist. That's a strange calling. But no, you know, I mean, I was a restless kid growing up in the Southeast, and no better way to put it. I was just restless. You know, I was always climbing trees and rocks and just kind of getting out there and driving my parents crazy. And then I moved to Colorado when I was 19 years old, and I didn't know why. I just went, and now I know why. Looking back 20 some years later, you know, I realized it was to answer a call that I had deep inside. And I fell in with some groups of guys that, you know, kind of had that restless tendency, and they took me under their wing. They're a few years older, and they taught me how to climb. And that desire, just a hobby, quickly turned into a career, and I started guiding bigger mountains and you know, more challenging mountains. And I very quickly got introduced to a guy named Eric Weinmayer. And Eric is blind. He was born legally blind. He had a degenerative retina disease called retinaschisis. And his retinas unraveled as he grew older. So at the age of 13, he was completely blind, lights out, black, pitch black. And he decided he didn't want to just let life just sort of pass him by, and that he wanted to be proactive. And he found climbing, rock climbing, to be his thing. That was something where he could express himself, he could challenge himself, he could be somewhat independent, moving on the rock and feeling the shapes and the features of the rock, but yet still be a part of the team. And he at a certain point said, "Hey, I want to take this rock climbing thing to the next level. I want to start climbing big mountains." But he needed a team. He needed people. He needed a guy. And he tells me the story that, you know, he had this whole list of people that he was calling and asking, you know, if they'd be his guide. And at the end, they'd be like, "Oh yeah, sure." And then, you know, he'll throw up as well, "You know, by the way, I'm blind too." And then suddenly everybody seemed to have, you know, like a dentist appointment or something that day. And no one was really willing to go out with the blind guy. So
I would imagine that's a little intimidating too, because you certainly, well, you know, safety is a huge thing. So you did it just because?
Well, I did it because we met. I didn't agree to do anything. We met and we got along really well. Just enjoyed each other's company. And that's, you know, that's the foundation of any good team. Is a group of people who really care about each other, you know, and want to be with each other and enjoy spending time doing things together. And so that became sort of the cornerstone of what we would later go on to do. And yeah, we quickly sort of turned our attention to bigger and bigger stuff. We went and climbed Denali up in Alaska, the biggest mountain in North America, and went down south and climbed the biggest mountain in South America, and then to Yosemite and climbed El Capitan, some big walls, and then kept going and going, and suddenly we found ourselves face to face with the biggest mountain in the world, and in Everest in 2001. We were fortunate enough to have a really great team around us, and we summited Mount Everest. A group of friends, just a group of buddies. There was no guide, you know. And all of us just went, had a good time, and challenged ourselves, and we were fortunate enough to stand on top. And so from there, I was given the opportunity to sort of develop my craft of public speaking, and that's where, you know, the desire to discuss some of our adventures, some teamwork, diversity, accountability, communication, failure, success, all these different themes that we all face day to day, professionally, personally. So I just started, instead of being paralyzed by fear of talking in front of the groups, I really started to enjoy it and see that there was some really positive feedback, and people said it was applying to a lot of different aspects of their lives, in some of our adventures and challenges. So that's where that all kind of came from. And from there, you know, I enjoyed being in the mountains, and I feel like the mountains to me are kind of like church, and that's where I feel spiritually the most alive. And so I think when providing people a medium like that, a venue like the mountains, a lot of people can tap into that And that's why we started the Expedition Company. And my wife and I run that, and we send people all over the world, you know, to go climb. Not very hard mountains. You know, we're talking Kilimanjaro, which is hard enough, and go trek through the Andes in Peru, and go to Bhutan, and really feel the Himalayas, and things of that sort. So that's where that kind of came in to play as well.
So that's very cool. Now, do you get to go to each of these? I'm looking at your adventure packages. Like, you have a Mount Everest base camp track. Are you the leader on each of these packages, or do you have a team of individuals that you ship out?
No, that's a great question. So, I mean, obviously, I have a little boy, and I'm also a physician assistant in the emergency room here in Denver, so I practice emergency medicine.
Gotcha.
So I've got a lot of things going on, and I can't very well go on every single trip we do. So the real critical thing that I've done over the years of going to all these places and guiding these expeditions is I've established strong friendships with local folks. And
mm-hmm.
so when I can't go, which I usually do 3 or 4 trips a year, when I can't go, I send our clients I put them in the hands of my local people who I've forged a strong and very trustful relationship with over the years.
Right.
And I know that they'll represent me and my company, and they understand safety and accountability, and all these things I talk about are really crucial. So that's why folks come with us. So whether I'm on the trip or not, it's been forged over years of going back and forth to the Andes and the Himalayas and places like that.
And to push it further, with all of the things that we've already discussed, you are also a writer. You have you've authored a book, Lessons Beyond the Summit.
Mm-hmm. Which, to be honest with you, was probably the hardest thing I've ever done, is write. I love writing, and I write blogs after every one of my trips, and I always enjoy that process of sort of revisiting a trip when I come home. It's neat to, you know, come home and take a shower and relax and wash clothes and not be stinky and smelly anymore, but then, you know, 2 weeks later be able to write and reflect on that story and go back there. So but writing a book was challenging, and I did enjoy the process, but it was definitely very challenging. And yeah, the book is a real short chapters based on some of my experiences, with each one with somewhat of a lesson at the end of the story.
So give us a story with a lesson.
So there's a few. Obviously, there's a lot. But let's see what would be a good one for you. Well, you know, the idea of being with Eric and being in a position where I'm the guy who has to make decisions for more than just one person. You know, there's plenty of situations when I'm with him where, you know, I can't think about my pain, my situation. I have to really try and remind myself very regularly in any situation that I'm in with him that I'm thinking for two. And then sometimes when I'm the leader, you know, I'm thinking for the whole team. So to tell you a story that has a lesson at the end of it, kind of sort of summarizing this idea on our summit night on Mount Everest. I hadn't been feeling too good up to then. I'd been worn out. I was pretty sick, as everybody was. And we rolled into camp. We all laid down, and we're going to take a nap in the afternoon, and we're going to get up. And our alarms are going to go off at 8 p.m., and we're going to head out the tent door at 9 p.m. We're going to climb all night to get up to this 29,035-foot mark. And we were all very nervous, and all of us worn down. We'd been going for over 2 months at that point. But we were all very committed to each other, and everybody had been playing their respective roles and stepping up when they needed to. And people had been stepping up for me, you know, because I had been tired and sick. But that night, something really special happened. When I woke up to get going, I felt this pretty remarkable sensation in my chest, right under my sternum. And that sensation, honestly, came. I didn't know what it was. I mean, it could have been a number of different things. I kind of have an idea now what it was, you know, 10 years later, but then I wasn't sure. But I let it take me, and it propelled me. It gave me strength for whatever reason, and I was way up in front of the whole group that night. Still dark outside, storming all around us, and I'd been following a rope to know, not necessarily which way to go. It was pretty clear it was only one way up, but I needed to know that that rope was there for my team to descend, to for a safe descent, because oftentimes the weather comes in and everybody gets, you know, disoriented, and then in our case, it would have been like the blind meeting the blind. So I needed to know that rope was there. And then following it, all of a sudden, it just stopped. It just stopped, and I saw that it went out to the left about 40 or 50 feet and then went up through this band of rocks, this nasty, broken-up band of rocks that I knew from my experience with Eric, if I took him up through there, that it would wear him out, that it would ruin him, and he probably wouldn't make it to the top. I could take him that way, which would be easy for me, but harder for him. It would be easy for me. The ropes were uncovered. It would be no work. Just walk around, follow the ropes, go up. But there was another option right in front of me that went straight up the same snow slope we'd been on for hours and hours, the kind of stuff that Eric loved.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same pace as the rest of us. Only problem is that right where I was standing, I saw it was buried under a foot or 2 foot of snow. And I would have to dig it out. And I sat there for, a few minutes. I remember laughing, like, just chuckling, like, thinking, this is great. This is perfect. This is like the textbook version of you're doing it for you, you're doing it for them, you know, and it was comical almost. But to that same note, like, it was so clear. I knew that my path was going to take me straight up, and I'm going to start digging. And I did. I started digging, and for me, that was in the rearview mirror was probably next to my child being born, the greatest moment of my life, because it was all so clear to me, and I could have chosen either way. And I dug those ropes out. That was my leadership moment, and you know, leadership has a lot of different definitions, and you can go to any bookstore you want, any Barnes and Noble you want. There's a thousand books on leadership.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, leadership is very simple. It's just showing the people around you your level of commitment for something. It's pretty simple, and it's dried up that way. It's very clear to me. And that, so I started digging, and I dug for 2 hours with that rope. And all my guys came up, and, you know, 2 hours later, and Eric came up, and they knew what I'd been doing, and we hugged, and we all kind of cried, and our tears froze to our cheeks, and we started off and went and summited it together and stood on top of the world together, and that was my leadership moment. You know, that was one of the defining moments of my life, and I'll always look back at that very fondly.
Very cool. And what was Eric's reaction? It must have been just as euphoric for him.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's a few little parts to that story that I did leave out. I told him I wasn't going to go on after we were standing on the South Summit, after he knew that I dug those ropes out. You know, it's like, man, I'm beat. I don't think I can go. And he knew that I dug those out basically for him and the team and for safety. And here I was telling him I couldn't go. So he was sad at first. I mean,
mm-hmm.
He actually told me later, he said, you know, I thought about not going because here I stood on every summit with him all over the world, and here was the biggest one of all, and he knew that I'd kind of given it to him, and so he was sad. And then without telling him, I reevaluated and realized, you know, I've got this strength. I looked over and looked at my blind buddy cruising across and about to go stand on top of the world, and I was like, I'm going, I'm doing it, I'll dig down as deep as I ever have. And I did, and I got right behind him, and we went over and stood on top together. And then when I got to the top, you know, he heard my voice, and he was excited that, you know, I had sucked it up and came over and stood beside him. So, yeah, there's a lot of – we went through the whole gamut of spectrum of emotions for sure that night. We went
I can imagine.
And sorrow to, you know, joy and elation and complete fatigue and rock bottom and everything in between.
So how long did that take to get your team up?
How long did it take to get us out there? 2.5 months from front to back.
Wow.
Which is a long time to do anything, any one thing.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of emotions wrapped up in that one moment.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah, a lot of commitment coming to fruition. But then, you know, when you're standing on top of the summit, you're only halfway. And, you know, it's part of mountaineering. And I think part of any big project, right, any big objective is, you know, when you reach the top, whatever that top is, whether it's symbolic or whether it's, you know, the top of the mountain, you know, you're only halfway. And you got a long way to go. And you best not check out. You best not become complacent and give up or say, ah, look what I did, and get too busy patting yourself on the back, because you got a lot of work in front of you still to be able to get down.
Mm-hmm. So in that 2.5 month period, there must have been a lot of bonding and you know, a real brotherhood. I'm assuming it was all men. I apologize if that's wrong, but a real tight-knit community, family.
Very much so. Very much so. I mean, to the point where, you know, we're brothers, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
It's, we've really gone through a lot. And when you go through an experience like that, it's, you know, you can always look back and just remember how much we all suffered together and how much of a bonding experience it was. And Eric and I have gone on to do a lot of stuff since then. We finished up what's called the Seven Summits, the highest point each of the seven continents. And we were actually, about a year and a half ago, we were in this race called Expedition Impossible, which is on ABC all last summer, or I guess, yeah, all 2 summers ago. And we finished second in that. It's an adventure race around Morocco. So we've continued to try and push ourselves and continue to try and see what the, you know, the different ends of teamwork look like, as far as just teamwork and communication and how to deal with adversity as a group of people.
Very cool. So you're listening to Living and Thriving with Rusty, and I'm Rusty, and very thrilled to have Jeff on from Mountain Visions. You can learn more about him at mountain-visions.com. You can see all of his speaking engagements. You've got quite a few lined up according to your calendar, you busy fella. And you can see some of his adventure packages and video. I like that. I like that you have the video on there too. You get a real good feel for some of the stuff that you're doing. So if you have any questions, give us a call, 347-205-9443. Jeff, give us an idea of what really inspires you to continue moving forward with these adventures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I mean, I've given that a lot of thought over the years. You know, what inspires a person it's so subjective, right? I mean, you know, you go and ask my mom what inspires her, and it's, you know, driving the little Fiat with the top down in the Blue Ridge Mountains, you know, and for me it's a little different. So I've had to sort of try and redefine that over and over, year after year. I'm a big fan of a guy named Joseph Campbell, who was an academic for years at in your neck of the woods up in the Northeast. And he, you know, he had a lot of stories and theories over the years, but his big one was really the more notable one was called The Hero's Journey. And really the hero's journey is about seeking out your bliss and finding bliss and happiness in what you do. Seeking out your bliss is just doing that thing that you cannot not do, right, that you have to do, and it just brings you so much joy. And that's an interesting question, I think, for each person to try and answer. But I also think it's a critical question that we forget to ask ourselves. I think that, you know, our society kind of allows us to be complacent, sort of fall into just sort of easy comforts. So when I try to ask myself that, I feel like I try to make myself uncomfortable every once in a while, just to kind of wake up that primal side of me. And I like to suffer a little bit, you know. I like to go through periods of deprivation and where I really push my body and my brain and my spirit, you know, and in an attempt to sort of kind of re-identify those places inside me that I know exist, that I found through mountaineering over the years, but all the while sort of seeking out my bliss, you know, and finding those things that I love to do. So, you know, I mean, mountaineering is always going to be there. It's always that thing that, you know, I can go climb a mountain and I've done it 20 times and it will still challenge me. No matter if I know it front to back, I will still be challenged. I will still get to a place where, you know, I'm finding a difficult place to be in. And so when I take that the next step, you know, for me, I have to challenge myself physically and mentally. I wanted to find a new sport that was going to really challenge me. And 2 years ago, I picked up the sport of kite surfing. And I've never done anything like that before. The wind has always been my nemesis. You know, I've always hated the wind.
Right.
It's killed my friends. It's ruined trips. It's driven me away from many summits. You know, the wind is always just this, like, it's just a bad thing. Well, I decided I didn't like that negative feel that I had for the wind. And so what sport could I try that would make, that would, you know, provide me an opportunity to be friends with the wind? Well, sport of kite surfing. It's kind of like windsurfing with a kite instead.
Yeah, I've seen it. It's new and it's becoming quite popular in the South. I would do.
Exactly.
I would have a lot of fun doing it.
I used to love
windsurfing.
Right, so it's kind of an extension of windsurfing to a certain degree,
yeah.
Right? And it's sort of the newer version where you just have a kite above you. And so I've found that, and it's really hard and very scary at first. But that's what I want, and I've become friends with the wind. And I seek it out now. I love to find the wind now and float across the water and try to be a conduit for the wind and the water. And so to me, that's bliss. That's challenging myself physically, emotionally, being scared, but yet trying to harness something that once really gave me a lot of fear. So that's most recently on my list. I just returned from being in the Dominican and Baja and kite surfing, you know, throughout the day and trying to get better at that. So, but I find a lot of joy in taking people into the alpine world and watching the transformation that they go through. Because even though, you know, a mountain like Kilimanjaro is not technically hard, it's hard enough. And everyone that I've done that mountain 12 times, and every time I have another group of, you know, 10 to 15 people, and every time I do it, every single person says to me at the end, that was the hardest night of my life, that summit night, the hardest night of my life. And they all have to dig down so deep. And they get their rears handed to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I love watching that process of someone have to go down to that just like, this foundational, fundamental level that they didn't know maybe they had, or if they did, they haven't been there in a really long time. And I watch them go through that, and it brings me a lot of joy to watch people go through that process, and they come back changed. And that's a metamorphic sort of process. And it's really, I feel very fortunate that I'm in a position to watch people go through that.
I'm sure it's cathartic for them. You know,
for some,
really,
I think it is. Yeah.
So give us a visual example for those people out there in Radio Land who really have no idea what digging down means. What does that mean? Can you describe?
Yeah, you know, I think that, and once again, I think it's different for every person. And we all have different places where that exists, that point where, you know, for me on Everest, it was, you know, I didn't know I had that place.
Mm-hmm.
That defined my lowest place, right, that I could go. I remember years ago, I was a teenager, I think, or maybe early 20s, and I was watching it was an Ironman. It was a television broadcast of the Iron Man. It's one of the first few. And these two women were battling it out. And I'm sure some of your listeners probably know the story, that they were battling it out, not for first place, not even for second place, but for third and fourth place. And they were within a couple hundred yards of the finish line. And they just had given everything they had to get to that point. And they were basically, you know, were down on their knees. And they were both crawling towards the finish line.
Mm-hmm.
And just in, like, agony. But they could not give up. No one could touch them. You know, their families and their spouses were around them. And they were just, you know, urging them on. And, you know, come on, you can do it. And the pain, this one woman was like a Rocky in a, you know, Apollo, like, final round. And they were just,
mm-hmm.
one woman would stand up and sort of go like 20 paces and just fall and collapse. And the other one would get up and they just, finally, they both crossed. They both just went to this deepest, deepest, amazingly painful place. I'm not suggesting that that's a good place to go, but to know that that exists is very, very powerful, that you can go there. And, you know, I don't know if I've been there, but I've been pretty close, and I like knowing that place. And I think that that's the place where people can go, and the mountains can take you there. And even though it sounds super painful, it's actually a joyful place to be when you go down deep and you think, I'm not so sure I can make this. But the reality is that, you know, you can, and you really can if you're surrounded by folks who can go there with you and take you there. And then when you come back, the hero's journey idea, when you come back and, you know, you've experienced that and you know that that place exists, I think it makes you stronger. I think it can really enhance your day-to-day because you can reflect back on that and say, wow, that was heavy. And it was a faraway place, you know.
Absolutely. I think it recharges that inner connection.
Mm-hmm.
Moments that are that deep when you're feeling like you want to completely give up and you just edge yourself one more inch. I think it makes you a stronger person on all levels, mind, body, and soul.
Absolutely.
And that carries out into your relationships as well with other people.
Yeah, it can't help but do that, right? I mean, when you kind of, and I don't want to say enlightened, but, you know, maybe that's too strong a word, but enlightened, you know, you're enlightened, you've kind of been somewhere and seen something that you hadn't before. So I think it does. I think it really does enhance everything from that point forward.
What was your scariest adventure?
Well, I've had a few. I've been in a couple avalanches, which scared me very much. One, you know, swept us down pretty far, and you know, buried up to my chest, and I had, you know, that was pretty scary. Fortunately, once again, I had people around me and that I trusted, and they helped dig me out. You know, I was looking back on that, you know, now it was great. At the moment, I was like, this is terrible. I want to go home. but it, you know, now in retrospect, it was good. And actually, the funny thing about that is that, you know, we were all really spooked from that, but we were at the base of the mountain we were going to go climb, and the question came up, like, do we want to continue on? And we actually did. We continued on and summited that mountain in Alaska called the Moose's Tooth. And, you know, it was just, you know, a wake up. And, you know, I've had several big falls and scary moments, whether in the Himalaya or, and, you know, on the side of a rock face. The funny thing is that, you know, the big mountains are frightening sort of from front to back. But some of the scarier times I've ever had have been on little local rock climbing faces, you know, just rock climbing, just, you know, 20 feet up, you know, from the last piece of protection in the rock and looking at a huge fall and, you know, and feeling like there's nowhere to move, no other holds, and I have to commit to it. I have to get it done, and or else I'm going to not only take a 20-foot fall, I'm going to go past that piece of protection another 20 feet. I'm looking at a, after the rope, you know, stretches a little bit, I'm looking at a, 45-50-foot fall. Those have been some scary moments for sure. But once again, I think those moments where you have to completely focus, push fear aside, those are the moments that, help define what I am now. But I got to tell you, Rusty, there's one thing. I mean, since I've had a child, my little boy is 7 years old, but since I've had a kid, my level of acceptable risk has changed dramatically.
Big time.
Oh, yeah.
Mine's 7 as well. And yeah, it's like a switch comes on, and
absolutely,
it's just so much different.
Totally different. And,
do you think you're going to allow him to run around and climb mountains and things like that?
You know, I mean, I would never hold him back from it. But
I know.
I've been pushing him towards other stuff. I feel very, very lucky that I lived through my 20s and my early 30s. I really do. I mean, I feel very fortunate, and I don't want to waste that. And that now I'm a dad and a husband. I don't want to let my family down from just being selfish and going out and doing reckless things. But I like my risk. I can't not experience risk and a little danger and a lot of fear. I love that. It's part of who I am. But I try to keep it a little bit more, I guess, in manageable. I guess is a good word to use.
Well, it's not about you anymore.
No,
you know, it's
sure,
about the three of you. So interesting how all of your adventures have really strengthened that part of your personality so that you can now balance a family. I mean, before it was just your team. Now it's a different type of team. Pretty cool.
Yeah, and you never know how you're going to do it, the second one, the whole family thing. You just kind of, even though there's a million books written on it, you just don't know what kind of parent you're going to be. And so,
exactly.
Yeah, kind of an experiment. Hopefully he'll turn out all right.
They're fun. They're so much fun just to watch grow. It's amazing.
Every day.
All right. So talk to me a little bit about your 7 keynote program. What does that mean? What's
that
about? It says your 7 keynote programs. I'm assuming you have 7 different
keynote programs. Yeah, the 7 keynote programs. Yeah. Well, you know, all the different companies and organizations I speak to, they all have a different agenda, have different desires, different needs,
mm-hmm,
and different dynamics. You know, I've had so many experiences that, it's hard to capture them all in different keynotes and different presentations. So what I do is I've kind of focused a few down depending on what the dynamic of the company is. And
mm-hmm,
if, you know, in some cases right now we're doing these, developing these sessions for different companies that have some issues with communication. And then, you know, that breeds distrust. And so, you know, I'll come in typically and do a keynote that really focuses on communication and trust and really emphasize those themes by using some anecdotal stories that kind of lead me into the atmosphere of trust and communication. So I emphasize those a little bit more than I typically would in something else. And then we'll usually have the leadership team of that company come to Colorado and do a really cool sort of experiential Colorado Rocky Mountain-based, get your hands to feet dirty sort of experience where we're really sort of putting those themes to the test. We're putting a rope on. We're connecting with each other. We're communicating. We're building trust. And we're then having some really powerful dialogue that night and every day that you're here. And usually those go for a couple, 3 days. But we're really having some really cool interaction that allows these themes to be then placed into that particular company's culture and mm-hmm, where they sit, what they need, what's going on, and And it's been really fruitful. Sometimes, you know, I think of it as in a lot of organizations that I talk to, I see that there's some voids, and they've put a Band-Aid on it. And what we're doing is pulling that Band-Aid off. And in some cases, it's good to just rip that thing off, you know, and get going on what's underneath. Or in some cases, it's more useful to slowly sort of peel back and look at the layers and really sort of get some positive dialogue going, where we're really trying to pinpoint where the disparity is within the individuals and where the different departments, which is oftentimes the case, different departments that aren't communicating effectively, or to be able to sort of reach that final end result of a team working effectively and honestly and sincerely, where they want the other person on their team to succeed. It's and that's the dynamic you try to create, right, in a multi-dimensional team. Every single player wants every single other player to win. And when you really, truly want that, that's when the team starts to advance, right? I think, personally, and I've seen that. You know, if there's someone harboring resentment towards someone else, it manifests and creates an atmosphere where the team starts to break itself down. And that's what we try to do. That's what I try to do with my keynotes as well as some of the sessions we do out here in Colorado.
So give us an example of some basic ways to have better communication in any situation, you know, whether it's partnership or romantic relationship or friendship. You know, there's got to be kind of a basic five-step.
Right, but what I typically, I mean, my life has been revolved around the mountains, right? So I fundamentally always go back to, you know, this idea of being in the mountains and being on a rope team. Once again, you know, there's been a million books written on how to communicate effectively, how to communicate with your departments effectively, you know. So there's a million different ways, and everybody's got a great idea, and they're all great, and I'm sure they're all useful. So where I, you know, sort of bring my anecdotal perspective is from this idea of being on a rope team. And when I think about, you know, being on a rope team and what that means, think about it, just visualize being on the side of a mountain, being connected by a rope. You got five people on your rope. And there's crevasses everywhere on this mountain. And yet you have to navigate your rope team conjointly around these crevasses, around, you know, avoiding certain walls and potential obstacles and hazards. But you can't do it without feeling connected to your people around you, because you're physically connected, but are you emotionally connected? Are you truly feeling connected to those people? Not just by the physical rope, but are you feeling connected? And so without getting too kumbaya and too touchy-feely and sitting around and patting each other on the back, you know, I always try to remind my clients and the people I speak to in the keynote presentations is you really have to powwow prior to embarking on any big journey objective and really establish, what is success going to mean? What does it mean for our team? How do we define that? And what does it mean for each individual? Mm-hmm. Right? And in a mountaineering sense, like, what does it mean? Are you defining it by a successful summit? Are you defining it by whether we get down alive? You know, like, let's get fundamental and figure it out. And let's really draw that out and make sure we all understand. We don't have to all agree on the same thing. We all have to understand what the other person on our rope team defines as success. And that's fundamental. And I think a lot of teams strike out with this sort of like, I assume what the people around me want and what they define as success. But do I really know? And I feel like I've been a part of several teams where that hasn't happened. I've heard it in my pre-conference calls and you know, post-event questionnaires, you know, with companies where well, we thought we really all were driving towards the same thing. Turned out we weren't.
Right.
Well, you know, fundamentally, that's a big issue. So defining success, to me, allows, I think, everybody to sort of really get a good understanding of fundamentally where everyone else is. And then I think understanding accountability for your own actions breeds positive communication. Understanding that my actions are not only affecting me, but my actions have a trickle-up and trickle-down effect. Wherever I am on that rope, whether I'm the first guy or the last guy on that rope team, I have to understand that what I do is really, truly going to puddle out and affect every single other person. And I think it's easy to say that. It's easy to say that I understand that. But once again, when you put, you know, feet to snow, do you really live that? Do you really understand, like, I am affecting every single person around me, positively or negatively? It is what it is. But I have to hold
right.
myself and the people around me accountable. So I think that's a two, for me, that's where it starts. And there's obviously a lot of shades that go in there. You know, for me, that's just before you even leave, before you even strap your boots on and put your pack on, those things have to be in place to be able to effectively communicate. Because without that, you're left sort of halfway up the mountain going, well, wait a minute, I thought this, and I thought that, I assumed this and that, and then that just sort of that breeds distrust, and then communication starts to fall apart, you know.
So in the last couple of minutes, what is the one thing that you really want everyone that is listening today to take away from you and your work and your inspiration?
Well, let's see. That's an interesting way. So if I can, you know, really sort of encapsulate it, I think what I would say is I would encourage every person to, number one, consider what it is that is their bliss. What is it that you need to do that perhaps you haven't? What is it that, you know, is sitting back there in some very, very primal place, your brain, that you've thought about, the place you want to go, something you want to do, that for whatever reason has just been pushed aside for years and years. And then I would say identify it and then manifest it, put it out right in front of you. Say, this is something I'm not thinking about anymore. I am doing this. And then, as Campbell says, surrounding yourself with allies and mentors, creating a team, putting together a group of people that share that common desire and that objective, whatever it is, whether it's go trek around the vineyards of Napa or, you know, go to the Mediterranean and explore Greece, or whether it's, you know, get your GED or, you know, go back to school and further your education or whatever it is, something that seems way far out there, but seek it out and surround yourself with a team that is supportive and nurturing for you, and then go out and get it. And take a risk at failure. Take a chance and see what happens, because, you know, it's not written that you're going to succeed. It never is. And the chances, in some cases, of failing are way higher than succeeding. And I think it's okay to do that, too. And then once you go out and do that, once you fall down a few times, use your failure as feedback, you can charge harder and be able to maybe add different components to your quest. And you come out the other side, changed and new, and you know where that bottom level is, you know where you can go, and then share it with other people. And that's the end of that circle of the hero's journey, is then sharing it with other people and inspiring them and then pushing them out into the arena and letting them go out and have that same sort of journey. I think that would probably be my 2-minute synopsis.
No, that was perfect. It resonates with a lot of what I do on the radio show here. I'm a huge believer that you have to fail, and it's good to fail, and it's actually a positive and not a negative. If you don't fail, then you'll never understand or appreciate success. You'll never grow internally to become the person that you are meant to be. So I'm a pro-fail girl, you know. 10,000 tries for Edison just to make a light bulb. It was the 10,001 he was successful. So, no, I think that's great. motivation is definitely something that comes from the inside, and you have to really want it. So I love the fact that you encourage people to look at what they really want and just to step outside of themselves and skin their knees once or twice or how many times it takes in order to be in that place that you really want to be in. Very cool.
You got it.
So talking to Jeff Evans of Mountain Vision, he's out in Colorado. I'm sure it's colder there than it is here, so I can't complain too much. If you have any questions or you want to reach out to him, definitely look up mountain-vision.com and check out some of the stuff he's accomplished. It's just amazing. And he's skinned his knees a couple of times, as we've talked about. So it's good stuff. Also a motivational speaker, so... Let's see, how many, I'm trying to look at your speaking calendar. You've got quite the lineup.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate in that sense. I've created a lot of relationships with companies and get invited to come back frequently. So, yeah, it's been,
absolutely.
Been good.
So we have about 5 minutes. Do you want to talk about the Soldiers to Summit expedition real quick?
Yeah, I'd love to. That's a project that's near and dear to my heart. About 3 years ago now, Eric and I decided we wanted to pay a debt of gratitude back to the men and women that serve our country. And, you know, we'd never served, and we felt like we wanted to say thank you. We weren't good at many things, but we are good at one thing, and that's going up and down mountains. So we decided that we wanted to create a project where we were going to take wounded veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, U.S. soldiers that were wounded recently in the past, you know, 5 to 10 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, and take them up big mountains. And the first one was 2 years ago, and we took a group of 11 to Nepal, and we climbed a big mountain there called Nobuche, which is a 20,000-foot peak. And it was a huge success. We had an amazing time, and the participants for that program came away changed. And several of them, it really pulled them back from a very dark place that they were in. We're talking all different sorts of injuries, physical injuries, you know, limbs lost, blind, blindness, but more importantly, and not more importantly, but just as well, a lot of post-traumatic stress issues and traumatic brain injury. And so we took them to Nepal, and the trip was such a success. Matter of fact, there was a film made while we were there called High Ground. It was just released this past Veterans Day, and it's making the rounds. I saw it on a United flight the other day, and it's also available on Netflix called High Ground, and it's really worth seeing. It documents our journey in Nepal. Also, we just got back from Cotopaxi in Ecuador, climbing a 19,000-foot peak just this past December with another round of participants, and we're looking to continue on. It's a very worthwhile project, and as I mentioned from the outside, Russ, the idea for me in the mountains are a very therapeutic place to heal, and I think that's the backbone of this project, and we've seen a lot of healing happen as a result of this project.
That's very cool. What a cool life. What a cool adventure. And thank you for all that you do. Very good stuff.
Thank you. And, my pleasure. I enjoyed talking with you today, Rusty. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You're great. And as your adventures, I'll keep following you online. Just amazing stuff. Everything that you're doing and all the healing and getting people back to earth and challenging themselves. It's just beautiful. Good job.
Thanks.
High five.
High five.
All right. So you're listening to Living and Thriving with Rusty. We're wrapping up. I had the joy of talking to Jeff Evans, who I still think is a crazy adventurer, but it's all for the good. It's for the better of the people and for the better of himself. And it's just very cool stuff. This life that I live, meeting all of these amazing, inspirational, wonderful characters, I just could not be more joyous. So thank you for joining us today. And Next week, I have Good in the Hood coming on to talk about their programs. Really neat organization that has travel dental programs. They have food shelves for college kids who are starving. I only remember eating ramen soup myself, but they serve over 500 families each month, and they have a Shoe Away Hunger campaign collecting used shoes for 7 days' worth of groceries. So it's going to be an interesting show. Feel free to tune in, and that's Good in the Hood, and it's with Sean Morrison, the executive director. So I'm looking forward to talking to him and learning more about what inspires him. As always, I love you. I think you're beautiful. I hope you have a wonderful week. And until next week, pay it forward. Do something random, random acts of kindness. You know, that really touches my heart. And live and thrive.
You're listening to Living and Thriving with Rusty.